Joe Biden won't do it, Jim Webb might still do it, and the Saturday Night Massacre certainly did it. All that and more on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Jim Webb ran out of time on the Democratic stage. Could he make a difference if he ran as an independent?
It is so much harder for an independent to go forward in a presidential campaign, and that requires either an extraordinary amount of money and an ability to build a network of followers in 50 states, and that would be a challenge for Jim Webb.
So, if your name is Clay Aiken, do you consider yourself a celebrity or a politician?
I'm both and neither. I'm a former of both of them, I guess.
And we recall how a big shakeup on a Saturday night in 1973 led to Richard Nixon's downfall.
My secretary came into my office and said that Alexander Haig is on the phone down in your office. There's an elevator between the attorney general's office and the deputy's office. Going down the elevator, I knew what I was going to be confronted with.
That's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And like to you, and lean to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 99 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The big news of the week, though maybe not a surprise, was the announcement that Joe Biden will not be a candidate in 2016.
Unfortunately, I believe we're out of time, the time necessary to mount a winning campaign for the nomination. But while I will not be a candidate, I will not be silent. I intend to speak out clearly and forcefully to influence as much as I can where we stand as a party and where we need to go as a nation.
The vice president insisted, though, that he intends to be a factor in the battle for the White House. But the Democrats still found themselves with a new star.
Senator Sanders, some of your opponents believe regulating Wall Street is enough. What is your position on the big banks?
Not a fan of the banks. They trample on the middle class. They control Washington. And why do they chain all their pens to the desks? Who's trying to steal a pen from a bank? Makes no sense.
That, of course, is Larry David portraying Bernie Sanders during a fake debate on Saturday Night Live.
You know what? Can I just jump in here? This may not be great politics, but I think the American people are sick and tired about hearing about your damn emails.
Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you, Bernie. God, it must be fun to scream and cuss in public. I have to do all mine into tiny little jars.
Hey, what's the deal with emails anyway? I forgot my password the other day, so they say, we'll email you a new one. But I can't get into my email to get the password.
With Biden not running and Jim Webb dropping out of the Democratic contest, the immediate effect is that Hillary Clinton has built on her lead as her party's national frontrunner. Her margin over Sanders has increased since the October 13th debate, the real one. On the Republican side, Donald Trump has once again taken aim at the Bush family. This time, it's over 9/11 in an interview with Bloomberg TV's Stephanie Ruhle.
I need to know that you will make us feel safe and you will make us feel proud.
I think I have a bigger heart than all of them. I think I'm much more competent than all of them. When you talk about George Bush, I mean, say what you want, the World Trade Center came down during his time. If you look
You can't blame George Bush for that.
He was president, okay? Don't blame him or don't blame him, but he was president. The World Trade Center came down during his reign.
That led to a blistering response from Jeb Bush on Twitter. Quote, "How pathetic for the real Donald Trump to criticize the president for 9/11. We were attacked and my brother kept us safe." Well, Trump had a Twitter response of his own saying, quote, "At the debate, you said your brother kept us safe. I wanted to be nice and did not mention that the World Trade Center came down during his watch." Jeb then went on CNN.
It's what you do after that matters, and that's the sign of leadership. Does anybody actually blame my brother for the attacks on 9/11? If they do, they're totally marginalized in our society. It's what he did afterwards that matter, and I'm proud of him, and so are a bunch of other people. You don't have to have your last name named Bush to be able to understand that. And it just calls into question Mr. Trump's credibility as a commander-in-chief and an architect of the next generation foreign policy, which we desperately need in this country right now.
Here's what I got out of all of this. One, stop saying that attacking a fellow Republican is going to hurt Trump, because up to now, Trump has been attacking nearly every Republican in sight, and the polls show that people don't care. It's not hurting him. Two, once again, it links Jeb with his brother, and while many Republicans still think fondly of W, others do not. The wars, the spending, the near collapse of the economy. I'm not convinced that constantly putting Jeb and his brother in the same sentence is good for the former Florida governor. Three, it's clear that Trump gets great joy in getting under Jeb's skin. He continues to do it because he knows it works. And four, it's, once again, another story that puts Trump back in the headlines, which he kind of likes. There's also an interesting footnote in the latest NBC Wall Street Journal poll. Trump still leads, and Ben Carson is still in second, but the poll also shows more Republicans saying they wouldn't support Bush than those who wouldn't vote for Trump. And speaking of Trump, again, he's hosting Saturday Night Live on November 7th. And that leads to this week's trivia question. But as the official Political Junkie rules dictate, whenever my mom is in town from Florida, she gets to read the question. Hi, Mom.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. It's nice to see you again. I haven't seen you. How long have you been in town? A week?
Saturday was when I came in.
Yeah, I'm glad I have you on the show so I can see what you look like. You look great. Every time you're on the show, people say you look better each time. You look younger each time. How is that possible?
Well, I used a lot of makeup this time.
Yeah,
I knew I was going to be on the radio.
I know that the audience knows that you live in Florida and that your son is a political junkie. But I also understand that when you're in the pool, when the kids yell Marco, you yell back Rubio. Do you do that?
Who told you that?
It says so here in the script.
Oh.
Wait. See, it says it right here. I thought it might be a funny joke. I guess it wasn't a funny joke at all. You live in Florida, as we said, and, you know, that's also the home of both Rubio and Jeb Bush. It probably hasn't started yet, but since you live in such a key state, do you, like during election time, do you get bombarded with commercials all the time? Is it really crazy?
Well, yes, we get phone calls all the time.
And commercial on TV?
Well, yes, on TV, but don't you get the same stations?
Not the Florida stations. Although, I was thinking of buying a TV in Florida so I can get all the Florida commercials. Would that work?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I know all about this technology.
Right, you heard about these 8-tracks that they have. Okay, so anyway, I'm so thrilled that you're on the show. And just to make things clear, you know, I'm not Neil Conan, right? I'm the other guy. You know that?
Yeah. I knew that right away.
Okay. So anyway, what's this week's trivia question?
You mentioned that Trump is hosting Saturday Night Live next month. Who was the first incumbent president to appear on Saturday Night Live?
And if people know the answer, what should they do?
Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Was that trivia with an R, trivia?
No.
Okay.
Trivia.
Because you and I have the same Bronx accent, I think.
Oh, do I have a New York accent?
I think a little bit. Anyway, we'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show. So stay tuned. And, Mom, I'm so happy you're on the show. I love seeing you because if it weren't for this program, we would never get to see each other.
Yeah, okay. Well, I love you, sweetheart.
I love you, too. See you later.
Bye.
In the scheme of things, it's unclear whether the recent announcements by Joe Biden and Jim Webb will prove to be big deals. There were always questions as to how Biden could make a difference this late in the game, and ultimately he decided he couldn't. As for Webb, who said last week he was leaving the Democratic race, but left open the possibility of an independent run, that's also unclear. He has been mired in single digits and has not been a factor in the campaign at all. He was a non-factor in the debate, probably best remembered for complaining about the lack of time he was getting.
I've been standing over here for about 10 minutes trying.
Okay.
It's gone back and forth over there. Let's start, I'm trying to get in this conversation about 10 minutes. Let's start with why Russia is in Syria right now. And I would say this, I've been waiting for 10 minutes. I will say this.
You're over your time, though.
You've let a lot of people go over their time.
But in his remarks announcing his withdrawal, there were hints that he may be leaning towards mounting an independent run for the presidency in the general election.
More people in this country call themselves political independents than either Republicans or Democrat. I happen to agree with them. Our country is more important than a label. Poll after poll shows that a strong plurality of Americans is neither Republican nor Democrat. Overwhelmingly, they are independents. Americans don't like the extremes to which both parties have moved in recent years, and quite frankly, neither do I.
Stephen Farnsworth is a political science professor and director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington in Virginia. And he joins us now on The Political Junkie. Steve, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
I know you were coming on to talk about Jim Webb, but the news of the week seemed to be the announcement by Joe Biden that he's not going to be a candidate in 2016. What do you make of that announcement?
I think that that Biden had a difficulty in terms of the timing, but also in terms of where the poll numbers stood for him. A lot of pollsters had been asking the question, what if Biden were in the race? And the results consistently showed him looking at a third place status if he entered the race. And that's just not a real position of strength from which a sitting vice president can mount a campaign. Clearly, Biden's prospects would have been better if he'd moved faster. But personal issues got in the way, of course, with his son's illness and death. It's an unfortunate situation for Biden, but I think it's a practical calculation based on where things looked right now in terms of the time between now and Iowa, the amount of money he'd have to raise, and the poll numbers that he was looking at going into this race.
Now, I know you've been watching Jim Webb's political career for a while, and you're also aware that he also didn't have the greatest poll numbers in his bid for the Democratic nomination. But you could see that he wasn't always in lockstep with the prevailing views in the Democratic Party.
Well, that's absolutely true. What you see with Jim Webb and his single term in the U.S. Senate is a more Southern Democrat of sort of a Jimmy Carter's generation, where you had more conservative politics than the Democrats often have today, but also somebody who really was kind of calling it as he saw it on the various issues. He really wasn't a committed Republican in those days when he worked for Ronald Reagan. He wasn't really a committed Democrat. He picked and chose the issues that he wanted. And one of the realities of politics today is that politicians who are not all that conservative a Republican or not all that liberal a Democrat are going to find a tough place finding a home in either party. As the partisan division of this country moves in further and further distance from the center, someone like Jim Webb has a tough time. Whether he runs as a Republican or runs as a Democrat, there's really a difficult place for him to find himself.
Yeah, I was going to say, even before coming to the Senate, as you point out, he was Navy Secretary in the Reagan administration, so some people thought of him as a Republican. But he also opposed the war in Iraq from the beginning, which was, I guess, a Democratic position. And it just seems like that Webb never really fit in with either party.
Well, that's a difficulty. But what you saw with Webb during his term in the Senate was somebody who was really much more of a workhorse than a show horse. And, you know, those politicians who really dig in seriously to issues are not really all that well rewarded by the media or in the court of public opinion. I think Webb had a really, really effective track record in terms of dealing with issues like criminal justice reform, dealing with issues of the VA crisis, the Veterans Administration, healthcare crisis. I think that that Webb had a single term that was quite successful, really, when you consider how little most senators are able to do in their entire careers. But again, these were not those hot-button Democratic issues that would really build up the kind of following in a Democratic presidential campaign that you see Bernie Sanders enjoying or, of course, Hillary Clinton enjoying at the moment.
How come Webb didn't run for a second term in the Senate?
All indications were that he was pretty frustrated with the Senate. He would have won a second term had he run. The poll showed high approval ratings for him as he finished his first term. But it was clear that the sort of can-do politics that he believed in was not well suited to the slow-moving, if moving at all, U.S. Senate. He's the sort of person, I think, who might make a better governor than a senator. And so I don't imagine that we've seen the last of Jim Webb in electoral politics, be it the possibility of an independent campaign next year for president or perhaps a gubernatorial election in the years ahead in Virginia.
He didn't raise much money during his presidential bid. If he were to run as an independent, is there any sign that he'd have any more success raising money?
Well, ultimately, what you need when you're talking about an independent campaign for president is an extraordinary amount of money. And as you say, Webb did not show in the presidential campaign as a Democrat that he was capable of raising that. For a Webb campaign as an independent candidate to go forward, it really would require an extraordinary level of fundraising. Democrats and Republicans have huge advantages when you talk about qualifying for the ballot in the 50 states in a presidential election. An independent candidate, whether it was Ralph Nader or Ross Perot or anybody else, has to spend a significant amount of time and money just with the mechanics of getting on the ballot in the 50 states. And the rules are different in every state, and so you need to build an organization that basically can get you a spot at the starting line. It is so much harder for an independent to go forward in a presidential campaign, and that requires either an extraordinary amount of money, like Ross Perot had, an exceptional level of public service commitment and an ability to build a network of followers in 50 states like Ralph Nader had. And that would be a challenge for Jim Webb, whose political career has been within Virginia largely.
And even with Ross Perot and his bank account, I mean, he spent $60 million in 1992, which was a tremendous amount of money back then. And he also came away with zero electoral votes. So we know the history of third-party candidates, independent candidates in this country.
Right. And Ross Perot, I think, you know, when you look at the Ross Perot campaign, that's really sort of the high watermark. If you go back 100 years, nobody did better than Ross Perot. And so when you look at those kinds of barriers to participation, you can understand why a lot of people who talk about doing third-party campaigns eventually are dissuaded from it. It costs a huge amount of money, and the return is pretty tough when an awful lot of voters go into the voting booth worrying that if they vote for a third-party candidate, the major party candidate they like the least ends up in the White House.
Well, humor me on this. I mean, let's say the presidential race comes down to Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. Both candidates have their supporters, but both are also lightning rods for controversies. Could Webb running as an independent become somewhat of a factor, either in Virginia or other states, maybe?
Well, I think that when the race is close, an independent candidate really can make a difference in a few key states. And those states that are pretty much evenly divided, and clearly Virginia is one of the most competitive states in a presidential election cycle in the country. I'd put Florida, Virginia, and Ohio in the top three. You're looking at a situation where a small percentage of the vote, 5% or less maybe, could be enough to tip the vote from one candidate to another. And so there's no doubt about it, whether it's Jim Webb or some other candidate running as an independent, if the election is really close, that may have a significant impact, not in terms of necessarily electing an independent president, but in terms of denying the presidency to one of the two major party candidates because of the popularity of that independent.
Steve Farnsworth is a political science professor and director of the Center for Leadership and Media Studies at the University of Mary Washington in Virginia. Steve, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
In a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I'll stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out.
We have to remind ourselves that before we get to the 2016 elections, there's 2015 that we have to deal with. Three states are holding gubernatorial elections this year: Kentucky, Louisiana, and Mississippi. In Kentucky and Louisiana, the governor is barred from running again, while in Mississippi, the incumbent is favored for a second term. The results are not expected to send any message for 2016, but there's always the issue of bragging rights. Karen Bergerman covers these races for National Journal's Hotline and joins us to tell us about them. Karen, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the governor's race in Kentucky. That seems to be getting the most attention. Who's the incumbent and who are the candidates running to replace him?
We have The incumbent Democratic governor is Steve Beshear, who's been there for two terms. And then we have running are the attorney general, Jack Conway, who's a Democrat. And then the Republican nominee is Matt Bevin, who ran against Mitch McConnell in the 2014 U.S. Senate race and lost to him in the primary.
Beshear was very popular. I mean, he's leaving after two terms because of term limits, but he has pretty good poll ratings, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's still relatively popular for a Democrat in a conservative trending state. But people don't know if that's necessarily going to rub off on the Democrat running now. I think people see Beshear as sort of a singularly kind of centrist, kind of a statesman. He's sort of from an older generation, but it's a real contest. It's a real toss-up who will win the race this year.
It seems like if you look at Kentucky, it seems like while the Republicans always win the Senate races, the Democrats always win the gubernatorial races. What is it looking like right now?
The Democrats have a really strong chance, and that is partially because of who the Republican nominee is. Matt Bevin is seen as kind of a flawed candidate. He's a Tea Party guy. He lost a really rough race to McConnell last year. And McConnell generated all the attacks that are being used against him this year by Democrats. So they sort of had that playbook to work with. But it is a conservative state. So Bevin, despite his flaws, really does stand a chance. But he doesn't have the establishment support that some other Republicans would have. The Republican Governors Association has pulled their TV ads and is not airing ads for him.
Why'd they do that? Because the polls look close, don't they?
Yeah, it was a little bit of an odd move. The polls are close, and they had said that they wanted Bevin to spend more of his own money. He struggled with fundraising. He's self-funded most of his past campaigns, and he's only raised about $600,000, but he's put in a couple million, more so in the primary. But he has not raised the money that the Democrat, Jack Conway, has, and there seems to be some concern that maybe Bevin wasn't taking that seriously enough, and I think they wanted to see some more legwork from him, but they haven't ruled out going back on the air. But it was certainly an interesting move because that's not something they typically do.
You mentioned that Bevin ran against Mitch McConnell, and perhaps there was some split in the Republican Party in 2014 between the establishment wing led by McConnell and Bevin's Tea Party wing. So what's the role of not only McConnell, but Rand Paul, the other Kentucky Republican senator, in this governor's race?
There was a lot of speculation over will Mitch McConnell endorse Matt Bevin, because Matt Bevin refused to endorse him after he lost to him last year. But McConnell has, you know, as much as there was a huge, nasty primary last year, he is the leader of the Republican Party in Kentucky. So he's endorsed Bevin. He's held fundraisers for him. He seems to be doing what he can to support him. He's not being particularly vocal or, you know, loud about it, but he's doing what he can to support him. Rand Paul has done rallies for Bevin, but Bevin's just kind of an odd character, and people say that he doesn't necessarily take the advice of those more establishment Republicans. He said a couple weeks ago that he would support Ben Carson in the presidential race, even though Rand Paul's his home state candidate, and then immediately backtracked and said, oh, no, I support Rand Paul,
too. Oh, I forgot that he was running.
Yeah, maybe. But it was just a little bit of an odd way to interact with the two senators from your state.
And Rand Paul beat Conway for the Senate in 2010.
Right. I think Rand Paul would love to see Jack Conway beaten twice. And it is funny because you have two candidates who have lost Senate races running against each other, and someone has to win. So it's a really fun race to see how both of them have learned from their past losses. But you really are seeing a lot of the attacks against both of them just rehashed in this race. It's not a whole lot new.
Now, in Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, there's a rumor that he's running for president. I read that somewhere. But he's also term-limited for governor. And there's a big name in that Republican contest.
In that race, we have David Vitter, who's a U.S. senator from Louisiana, and he's perceived as the frontrunner in the governor's race. And, you know, I think for most of the year, people really thought it was just his race to lose. It's still that way, but it's gotten a little bit more interesting in the past couple weeks because you have him running. Louisiana has these jungle primaries. They're open primaries.
All the candidates are on the same ballot regardless of party.
Yes, right. That's correct. So you have him running against two other Republicans and one Democrat. And it's a little bit of a split. And how that works is if no candidate gets over 50% of the vote, then you go to a runoff with the top two. So it looks like
regardless of party.
Yep, regardless of party. Kind of like in California, they have a similar system. But so what looks most likely to happen is that Vitter will end up in a runoff against the one Democrat who's a state rep named John Bell Edwards. And there have been a couple polls that showed Edwards running competitively against Vitter. One from a local newspaper, The Advocate, actually had him beating Vitter. But there's some speculation over how accurate that is. It is just tough for a Democrat to win in Louisiana. It's conservative. They've had a really hard time winning over white voters who make up the majority of voters. So there's some skepticism over whether Vitter can actually be beat. But because of his past, there have been a lot of attacks lobbed at him. He had some scandals earlier in his career that have really stuck around. And
even though he's been reelected as senator, despite those scandals.
Yeah, he won reelection in 2010 to the Senate, even after some of those stories came out. But there's a little bit of a sense that now running in this open primary with Republicans attacking him on this, with outside groups attacking him on this, and people maybe holding governors to a different standard than a U.S. senator, it seems like it's a little bit more of a chaotic situation, but it would still be surprising if Bitter lost.
And one of the Republicans running against him, or at least in that race, is the lieutenant governor. So is the party split, or is there a chance that the runoff could be between two Republicans?
It's looking unlikely, but those two Republicans would love to make it into the runoff. And there are definitely Republicans that don't like Bitter. And between those two Republicans are each polling in like around 10 or 15%. So there are a number of Republicans out there who are voting for a Republican that's not Bitter. One is the lieutenant governor, who's maybe a little more moderate than Bitter. The other is a former Democrat who actually then became a Republican and worked for Bobby Jindal, who's not very popular. So they kind of have their own difficulties running as Republicans in that state.
I was going to ask you, is Jindal playing a role in choosing his successor at all?
He's not. It seems like he is, A, busy running for president, but also maybe knows that he's not the most popular incumbent and knows that if he made his mark on a candidate, it might not be to their benefit. He's not endorsed, and none of the Republicans running have endorsed him in the presidential race. Mm-hmm. They just seem to be keeping their distance from each other.
And we should point out that the election is Saturday, October 24th, right?
Right.
And then the runoff is when? Sometime in November?
November, mid to late November.
Okay. Finally, there's Mississippi. It doesn't seem to be much of a contest there.
No, we had an odd situation. We have Phil Bryant, who's a Republican incumbent. He's up for re-election, and he's just a lock to win re-election.
He was lieutenant governor under Haley Barbour, right?
Yes.
Right, okay. So he's running for a second term. And tell me about the Democrat.
The Democrat is a truck driver named Robert Gray, who won totally out of nowhere in their primary earlier this summer. Democrats were going to lose this race no matter who they had on the ballot. But they had a couple of semi-serious candidates. They had a lawyer who had raised a couple $100,000, and she lost to this truck driver who no one had heard of.
Who raised no money, who spent no money.
Right, and he said he didn't even tell his mom that he was running. And then after he won the primary, he said, well, gotta go run a shift off to Pennsylvania. I'll be back in a week. This just a real oddball character who isn't doing an already struggling Democratic Party any favors. And so, you know, Phil Bryant is not even going to debate this guy. It's not a real race. I think the state Democratic Party has felt a little uneasy about how to handle him as their candidate. The one thing I think Democrats are struggling with is they have a Democratic attorney general still. He's the only...
That's Jim Hood.
Yeah, only statewide elected Democrat. And so it could have been helpful for him to have a little bit of a stronger candidate at the top of the ticket to maybe get more people out to the polls. And I think that's looking close, but he's been more successful than other Democrats there.
Actually, that's probably the biggest race to watch in Mississippi, because Republicans feared that should he win re-election, he could be a future candidate for the Senate or governor, right?
Exactly. And, you know, attorney generals, we have a lot of them running for governor, you know, in Kentucky. Democratic nominee is attorney general.
Right.
And then you've got a couple more running next year. So those are always races to watch, because they are usually the next people look to for gubernatorial candidates or Senate candidates.
To see who's going to be the next governor, right?
Yeah.
Karen Brugman covers gubernatorial races for National Journalist Hotline. She's on Twitter at Hotline Karen, K-A-R-Y-N. Hotline Karen, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
There's always an element of entertainment when we're talking about politics. There are the celebrities who become candidates. Think Ronald Reagan and Shirley Temple and Fred Grandy and Sonny Bono. There are the celebrities who play outsized roles in campaigns. Think Oprah Winfrey endorsing Barack Obama back in 2007, or Clint Eastwood debating an empty chair at the 2012 Republican convention. And think of who's leading the GOP field for 2016. Speaking of Donald Trump, there was a bit of a brouhaha when the actor Anthony Mackie, who's in the new movie Our Brand is Crisis, said this on BET.
I would 100% want to run Trump's campaign. 100%. I mean, first, that'd be the best party ever when he won. And second, Trump's an easy sell. You know, I feel like if you look at Jane in this movie, Castillo was a hard sell because he just had a face that you didn't like. You know, if you look at Trump, he's an easy sell because you can sell him as the guy who worked his way up from nothing. You know, and I think that if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps candidate, people would identify with that.
Is this an endorsement for Trump now?
I'm on the bandwagon. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid.
Whether he was serious or not, Mackey became the target of much social media abuse, a lot of it race-related. He later said he was only kidding about backing Trump, but it was one more example of the risks entertainers take when they talk politics. Earlier this month, I attended Politicon, a conference in Los Angeles, where the roads of politics and entertainment came together. I was also on a panel on celebrity and politics with, among other people, the singer Clay Aiken, who ran for Congress last year as a liberal Democrat in a conservative Republican district in North Carolina. I had a brief opportunity to chat with Aiken afterwards about celebrity and politics.
Are you a politician or are you a celebrity?
I'm both and neither. I'm a former of both of them, I guess.
Obviously, you have passions on issues, and obviously that's what got you into politics. But when you campaigned, who was Clay Aiken?
You know, I'm somebody from North Carolina who was very upset at seeing, well, not only the partisanship in Congress, but the fact that my state has been cut apart and gerrymandered so much that people don't even have to do their jobs anymore. So I was kind of a little bit angry. Honestly, a little bit frustrated, but a little bit angry.
We're at this political conference here. It's supposed to be the confluence of politics and celebrity. Who's winning?
Who's winning? Celebrities are probably winning because they figured out how to get people to agree and sit down together and watch a show on TV or watch a movie or listen to a song and not fight. And politicians can't seem to get more than 10 people in a room without bloodshed somehow.
Donald Trump has proven that you can get a lot of people in a room and a lot of people watching you, and he is a quasi-celebrity.
He's gotten a lot of people in the room by saying some very incendiary things. You know, I think there's certainly an argument for the fact that he's brought some people out of the shadows in this country who thought they didn't have a voice, who thought that someone wasn't speaking up for them. You know, unfortunately, the things that he's saying and the people he's pulling out of the shadows, the people who are cheering him on, I mean, in some ways have some very frightening opinions and viewpoints. But I think it's very important that everyone who doesn't agree with him pays attention to the fact that there is a faction of this country, and maybe it was a silent minority, not a silent majority, but a silent minority who has some pretty, I won't call it backwards because that would be bad, but who has some pretty incendiary and frightening viewpoints. And we have to realize that. You know, I don't think that I knew that there was as much vitriol and hatred as I now realize, because Donald Trump has said, come on out of the nooks and crannies of America and let's have a rally together. And I mean, it's scary, but it should be somewhat enlightening, and we need to pay attention to it.
Is there a future for Clay Aiken, politician?
I ran because I saw a need in one particular district, my home district, with one particular incumbent. That was my purpose for running. If another opportunity or another need, if another need arises and I feel like that I have the ability to use the platform that I'm in to either affect a change in a policy area or bring attention to an important issue, then I would not shy away from a run again. That's the truth. But I'm not gunning for one, though.
There was one thing he said that I think people should pay attention to.
Hey, I'm Clay Aiken, and I listen to Political Junkie.
No, I'm still standing better than I ever did. Looking like a true survivor. Feeling like a little kid. I'm still standing after all this time. Picking up the pieces of my life without you on my mind. I'm still standing.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last Republican with a lead in the national polls in October of the year before the election who went on to win the nomination? The answer, George W. Bush in 1999. No Republican nominee since then had the lead in October. And the winner is Roseanne Braslow of Middleton, Wisconsin. Roseanne gets the coveted Political Junkie button. And we have a Scuttlebutton puzzle winner as well. Scuttlebutton, if you don't already know, is that Waste of Time contest where I post a bunch of buttons in a vertical line, and your job is to take a word or concept from each button and come up with a familiar saying or slogan people from Earth would recognize. In our last puzzle, the first button had a photograph with the caption, "Win with Chick." Then a David Cargo for Governor of New Mexico button, and finally one that read, "Re-elect Gubbs Congress." So when you combine Chick with Cargo and Gubbs, you may come up with Chick Cargo Cubs, the team that has been battling the New York Mets for the National League pennant, and they haven't won the pennant since 1945 or the World Series since 1908. And the winner is Scott Tiemann of Gwin Oak, Maryland. As always, you can find our political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt and puzzles, and much more on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
They're singing, "Go Cubs, go! Go Cubs, go! Hey, Chicago, what do you say? The Cubs are gonna win today. Go Cubs, go!"
And don't forget, next week is our Political Junkie special, Election 2016, 1 year out. As part of the show, we'll be answering your questions about the elections. You can leave your question on voicemail. Call 316-KEN-9646. That's 316-536-9646. And leave your question after the beep. Or you can send us an email at questions@krpoliticaljunkie.com. Make sure you include your name and where you live. It's time for This Week in Political History. One of the worst political scandals in U.S. history was about to get worse. Richard Nixon, already caught up in the Watergate mess that would ultimately end his presidency, was battling Archibald Cox, a special prosecutor during the scandal, when the existence of a White House taping system was revealed, and along with it the likelihood that Nixon was discussing the Watergate break-in and cover-up with his aides. Cox demanded the tapes. The administration said no, but they would hand over summaries of the tapes. That was unacceptable to Cox, and the White House knew it. A confrontation was inevitable, as explained by NBC's Tom Brokaw.
Good evening. There are reports tonight that President Nixon has ordered Attorney General Elliot Richardson to fire the special Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox. Cox opposes President Nixon's plan to release summaries of the presidential tapes in the Watergate case. Cox said at a news conference today he'll continue his court efforts to get the tapes, despite the president's orders that he give up that court fight. Richardson's office said the attorney general did not agree with the president's order to Cox to stay out of the courts, but White House sources say Richardson did agree. In any event, Richardson tonight is said to be considering his next move.
And then, on October 20th, 1973, 42 years ago this week, all hell broke loose. Here's NBC's John Chancellor.
The country tonight is in the midst of what may be the most serious constitutional crisis in its history. The president has fired the special Watergate prosecutor, Archibald Cox. Because of the president's action, the attorney general has resigned. Elliot Richardson has quit, saying he cannot carry out Mr. Nixon's instructions. Richardson's deputy, William Ruckelshaus, has been fired. Ruckelshaus refused in a moment of constitutional drama to obey a presidential order to fire the special Watergate prosecutor. All of this adds up to a totally unprecedented situation, a grave and profound crisis in which the president has set himself against his own attorney general and the Department of Justice. Nothing like this has ever happened before.
It was known as the Saturday Night Massacre. William Ruckelshaus, the deputy attorney general who followed his boss, Elliot Richardson, and refused to fire Archibald Cox, and like Richardson, quit over it, joins us now to talk about that awful day and those awful times. Bill Ruckelshaus, it's an honor to have you on The Political Junkie.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
I think everybody agreed that it was a time bomb waiting to happen, the White House refusing to give the special prosecutor what he wanted, Archibald Cox refusing to back down. Bring us back to the pressure that everyone was feeling at that time.
Well, the real reason the president wanted Cox gone was he was getting too close. His responsibilities as special prosecutor were to investigate the crimes that fell under the rubric Watergate. He had been appointed back in the spring of 1973. I was then acting director of the FBI, and Elliot Richardson had just been appointed as attorney general. And as the acting director, I was essentially Cox's investigative arm. And for several months, I dealt with him almost daily. And the pressure he was putting on the White House to produce the tapes, which had been revealed at the Irvin hearings in June of 1973, was pretty intense. And he was enlisting the courts in helping him gain the information that was on the tapes. And the president and his staff, particularly the president, was very nervous about the information on those tapes becoming public, and so he resisted with everything he had, including in October of 1973, ordering Elliot Richardson and myself to fire Archibald Cox, which neither one of us thought was warranted by anything Cox had done, so we refused.
I have a campaign button in my collection from 1968, the year you ran for the Senate from Indiana. It says Nixon, Whitcomb, and Ruckelshaus. If I remember correctly, you barely lost that Senate race in 68, but would you have considered yourself a Nixon Republican in 1968?
Certainly, to the extent that Nixon had moderate programs and tendencies, I certainly would have been a Nixon Republican. I didn't think of myself that way. I thought of myself as a Republican. My instincts were probably a lot more moderate than more moderate than the current Republicans. But I was in the more moderate camp even back in 1968.
But did you have a personal relationship with the president after he was elected? I mean, did he reach out to you after the Senate race?
I was reached out to by John Mitchell, who was the attorney general and had been a law partner of the president's. He asked me to be an assistant attorney general in charge of the civil division, which I accepted, and several of us were confirmed really before the president was confirmed. That's how fast you could get confirmed in those days.
Let me fast forward to 1973. There had long been talk about impeaching the president, but the firing of Cox seemed to make it almost a certainty. Can you remember what those final days in October of 73 were like for you and for Richardson?
Well, they were quite intense days. We had just finished, over the course of that summer, an investigation into the vice president, Spiro Agnew, for the acceptance of bribes while he was governor of Maryland. And still that took place while he was in the vice president's chair. He resigned in October of 1973 when it was revealed what he had done. And Gerald Ford was almost immediately appointed as his successor by the president. And while that was going on, we were still deeply worried about the president's survival, given the charges of the Watergate and the more serious nature they were taking on every day. Both Elliot and I had talked about the possibility of the vice president of the United States being sworn in a criminal trial dealing with his bribes, while somebody burst through the door and said, keep your right hand up because you're being sworn in as the next president of the United States. That was a terrible situation, needless to say. Only the few of us knew how close all that was to becoming a reality.
When Richardson went to the president and said he wouldn't fire Cox, the decision then went to you. And I remember reading once that it was Alexander Haig who called you from the White House to tell you that, right?
That's right. He when Richardson came back to the Justice Department, having visited the president in the Oval Office, it was clear when he came in things hadn't gone swimmingly. And he said he had resigned. And just at that point, my secretary came into my office and said that Alexander Haig is on the phone down in your office. So as I took it, there's an elevator between the attorney general's office and the deputy's office. Going down the elevator, I knew what I was going to be confronted with.
Okay, so Richardson said no to firing Cox. You said no to firing Cox. Remind us, who fired Archibald Cox?
Bob Bork, who was then Solicitor General and had been for just a few months. He was the third in command in the Justice Department. Beyond him, there wasn't anybody. There was no chain of command that took into condition anybody beyond the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, and the Solicitor General. And Bob Bork had not been involved in the discussions over the course of the week leading up to that Saturday night. So he wasn't nearly as familiar with all that had taken place in the White House between the Justice Department and the president. But he agreed then to fire Archibald Cox when requested to do so by the president.
Let me put Watergate aside for the moment. You were the first administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. You were named by Nixon in 1970. Then you returned to that job in 1983 under Reagan. Tell me about Bill Ruckelshaus on the environment.
When I first took the job as administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, I had had very little experience in environmental law. In fact, there wasn't very much environmental law at that point. Most of the statutes that are currently administered under the environmental laws were passed in the 1970s. But I had been in the Indiana Attorney General's office, had helped draft the Clean Air Act for Indiana. Those laws were not nearly strong enough, in my view, to achieve the cleanup necessary for the country to deal with pollution. And we needed to centralize the responsibility for passing those laws in order for them to apply across the country, and people couldn't simply move to states that were more lax than others. And that's what led to the creation of EPA and some 10 statutes dealing with everything from clean air to clean water, pollution of all kinds during the decade of the 70s. And the country really has made enormous progress in cleaning up air and water. It's not finished. It's never finished. You can't walk away from these problems. They just creep up on you again. But we were much like China is today, that people see in the newspaper, and people have forgotten about that. It's the success we've had in getting cleanup has been so marked that a lot of that is forgotten.
When you look back at your career, what would you say was your proudest moment, your defining moment?
Well, I think it was starting EPA the first time. That was a monumental undertaking, and I think we had a lot of success because we were determined to take the laws of the land seriously, to work to find new laws or pass new laws where that was necessary. And the cumulative effect of EPA's actions, both when we started and from then on, have been enormous in protecting public health and protecting the environment in the country. And that is something I take a good deal of pride in.
William Ruckelshaus was the Deputy Attorney General under President Nixon. On October 20th, 1973, 42 years ago this week, he and his boss, Attorney General Elliot Richardson, both refused a White House order to fire Archibald Cox, the Watergate special prosecutor who was getting too close to uncovering the facts behind the break-in and the cover-up. Richardson quit, Ruckelshaus quit, and Cox was ultimately fired. The event was known as the Saturday Night Massacre, and it was the beginning of the end of the Nixon presidency. Bill Ruckelshaus, it was wonderful having you on the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible with support from WAMU here in Washington and is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. For political columns, trivia questions, scuttlebutt puzzles, and bad jokes, and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, check out our website at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or shoot us a message on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Our show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer. Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. And Claire Rudin played the role of Ken's mom. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.